Thank you for joining us again. This is a continuation of the previous episode. As always, here's your host, Nikesh Gosalia.
I'm going to focus on one thing that you said. It really stuck with me. But before that, I'm going to probably request the team to go back and pick one sentence that you said, which I think is almost a quote that I can put up anywhere. You said something like, SciComm should be every researcher's responsibility. I'm sure I'm getting the words wrong. It sounded fantastic when you said it, but that's absolutely true. I think science communication doesn't have to be a job. It doesn't have to be something you have to do to earn extra credits. It doesn't have to be something that you have to do to only promote yourself or do something or do it as a way to advance your career. It is something that probably is going to help every researcher in the longer run. And when there is a sort of merger or when there is a two-way relationship between a researcher and a research society or a publisher, then I think the effort or the impact of that science that is communicated, I think that's really amplified. And I also I really appreciated it when you said that everything a scientist or a researcher does to communicate that science should be recognized. Even if it's a high school talk, it is important because it takes effort. And in a way, it's a leveling ground because even the most experienced researcher may not really be good at communicating their science. So I think some amount of training is really required. But I think what I'm really going to focus on here is inclusivity, which is what you mentioned, inclusivity in academia, inclusivity in publishing, and also inclusivity in science communication. Something as small as using specific colors. We all know that when we present or prepare graphs, all of these colors are pretty much standard. But does everybody see them the same way? And do we really are we really communicating the science effectively if we are not thinking about, you know, the diversity of the audience? Are we taking the audience into account? So I'm going to just hang on to inclusivity again and introduce my next question to you here. So I know that you write about science for a Slovak daily newspaper and for international physics and chemistry magazines. And you also contribute to the portal of science exercises that your grandfather set up, which is pricklady.eu. Now, this is like a really diverse audience that you're catering to, diverse across age groups, interests, and incidentally, even languages. Given this, when it comes to communicating with millennials or Gen Z, do you think research societies or publishers should aim to be multilingual, or should we only go for an English-only approach? I'm also referring to or touching upon those opinions. A lot of people have written about how English has become the lingua franca of science communication or research. So what kind of approach do you think will really work here? And what can publishers and societies do to sort of amplify their SciComm efforts?
It's a really, really interesting area you're touching upon here. I think what we need to realize is, as I mentioned, science communication to me is partially marketing strategy. So you first need to be aware of your target audience. And I think that is really an important point here, because it's a huge difference if you're communicating science to a niche group of chemists that will read the online chemistry magazine. And it's a huge difference if you're trying to explain what are proteins to a group of students in elementary school, right? So that would be the first step in deciding what kind of language to use and what kind of level of the language to use as well. So to me, it's clear that when you speak with students, it makes really great sense to speak their local language, to adjust the messaging, and to even reach out to their teachers to check their level of experience and their knowledge level, so it would fit and you would not overwhelm them with information. But part of your question touches upon whether English should be used to communicate science generally, and maybe among scientists. It began with German, right? And especially in chemistry, it was all written in German at the beginning, and it slowly transformed into English. I think it's too late for us now to discuss whether it was a good decision or whether it makes sense. We are where we are, and we all speak English worldwide. All papers in academia are published in English and then maybe translated into another language. And since we currently run with a model of peer review, I think it just has to be done in English. Otherwise, you would be limiting the pool of your experts that can actually help in the process.
Absolutely spot on when you said it's not just about science communication, it's about marketing as well. But I think one of the challenges that societies might face, explaining the rationale behind this question, one of the challenges that societies might face now is we currently have a sort of explosion of digital tools, platforms, and channels available. Almost everybody has at least, not even an exaggeration, at least 1,000 channels to choose from. And given that, what should, you know, the thought was just what should be the main language that will really attract a younger generation or would entice even a younger generation of researchers, you know, to take up science communication and feel really excited about it and, you know, go ahead and talk about it to a lot of people. That was the rationale.
Maybe I would like to begin with, what is the best age to convince someone that science should be the part of their thinking and their behavior? At the beginning, maybe one thing I'd like to mention is that communicating science to young audiences for me is not performed to convince them to become a scientist only, but for them to realize that science is there to help them. It should be part of their job, part of their decision-making process. How to get the right vaccine, when to get it, how to behave when you get sick, when to take the antibiotics, when not to, etc. Right? How to clean your house effectively, all the things. So if we keep this in our minds, I think we should target children as early as possible, because unless you convince them when they are 10 years old that it's cool, that science is cool, it's too late to do it when they're 20. It's too late to do it when they're already at the university, just want to finish one degree and be done with the process and then just forget about everything. And if we are to target the very young children, it has to be done in their native language. And this is why, coming back to my previous points, really important that researchers should, in my opinion, not all of them, and we should not force them, but should consider spending some time going back to high schools, going back to elementary schools, talking about general science concepts to young children and their teachers. It's really important, and I think it will only benefit the entire society.
It's a really interesting perspective. I hadn't thought of it this way, and thank you for putting it across so simply and clearly. I'm going to take a slight detour, change tracks a bit, and come back to your personal experiences. So we just spoke about how you started science communication by sheer accident. And we're also talking about, in the course of this conversation, we've spoken about how publishers and societies could probably influence this or, you know, help researchers to some extent. So what kind of help did you get? And how did you sort of hone your own skills? Did you ever work with a publisher or a research society, or did you get any sort of help from them? And how did you just build from that first accident? How did you get to this point?
Right. So if we just focus on science communication and science writing, because that's what I consider to be the main part of my job even now, I was not aware that I enjoyed writing that much until my PhD studies, or maybe already in my bachelor's, because I realized that writing up my project into the thesis was actually pretty enjoyable. But it came at around the time when I started communicating science on social media platforms, when I realized that it's really fulfilling, it's fun, and it's pretty quick actually for me. And it's something that I discussed even with my PI at the university. And Professor Ward was really supportive. And I remember having the conversation with him when I decided to be really open and share that I'm considering not continuing in academia, but either going into industry or into medical writing or just focusing on science journalism. And that's when I remember he kept quiet, where I was a bit worried, and he stood up and took one book from his shelf. And since then, he kept bringing me materials to improve my writing skills and also allowed me to write all the publications from scratch, and he would just do the editing. So he was a really a fantastic source of support. And as I also mentioned, at the University of Basel, they are fantastic courses to choose from that develop your soft skills, your technical ability, your technical writing abilities, and language skills as well. I remember we even had a course on writing in academic English, for instance, and things like that. So I always try to use all of the opportunities that were out there. So maybe a bit of a tip to your listeners, if you're a student at the university, go online and check what kind of courses you have available. They can be life-changing, believe me.
Wow, it sounds like you had an amazing PI. So I think in your case, it was a fantastic mix of training and, based on what you said, actual practical experience when he got you to write all of those papers. And since you mentioned that you really liked social media and what you did there, that's the question that I'm going to bring up next. And this one's to wrap up this conversation. You set up an Instagram account to spark an interest in the natural sciences. And you also did it at a time when we can say Instagram was sort of stereotyped as a platform for selfies or for fashionistas.
Lunch images even, huh? Yeah.
Images of food, damn, which is what I'm guilty of too. But
Oh, me too. Don't worry. I have 3 profiles on Instagram. One is a personal one where I share pictures of my baking. The second one is for my dogs. And then I have the science communication one. So that's completely fine.
Oh my God. Okay, I'm not so guilty now. Thank you. So yeah, you chose Instagram, which was, we can say, to a great extent, stereotyped as a channel for a platform for selfies or fashionistas. But then you brought it to a stage where now your account has more than 32,000 followers. So could you tell us a bit about what it takes to run a successful science-based account on Instagram?
Good question. I think part of it was luck, because at the beginning when I started the Instagram account, the space was so oversaturated with pictures of food and selfies and things like this, that if by any chance my content would pop up on someone's feed, it was something new and interesting and it made them click. I also was always trying to take beautiful images of glassware, all of the reactions I was taking, or using different lighting and perspectives and things like that to capture their attention and then explain what was going on, use humor, etc. And I was always trying to keep the content really authentic. That was back then when I had it a bit easier because the content was creating itself. I was in a lab. I could talk about my work. Now it's a bit more complicated because I need to find topics that are relevant to my target audience and I can still access. I can't anymore just go to the lab and set up a reaction, but I can still make it work. But if someone wants to start now, I think it may be a bit easier because the audience is used to seeing all types of content from doctors, nurses, and researchers online, especially due to the pandemic, let's say. And it's not only limited to Instagram now, we have all kinds of things also on TikTok, still great YouTube channels, so plenty of platforms to explore. Science Twitter is really huge at the moment, but we probably all know about that. And some of the tips that I would share is do a little research about the platform you decide to explore. Nowadays, people tend to consume more video content, so ensure that you have a good camera, have a nice external microphone if you can. Now you can really buy them for $5 on Amazon. That's fine. And think about the content as if you were creating it for yourself or for a family member. Make it interesting and only focus on one message per video. Then it will work.
I love that you said think of it as though you were creating it for a family member. I think that really describes the effort you have to put in when you're really trying to communicate science to the people. I think I've taken up a lot of time, and I'm sure Nikesh has a lot of things he has to say too. I've spoken too much. I need to give way to Nikesh so that he can also, you know, introduce any other thoughts that he has or any other questions that he has for you.
No, thanks, Jayashree. I mean, this was fascinating. And I mean, this has been insightful, Martina. One of the things that definitely resonated and will stay with me is the fact that you said, you know, science has to be a way of life. I have to be very honest. I think for quite a long time, even my perception was that, you know, you have to learn science probably because you have to become a scientist. But like it happens with, you know, so many of us, when you have a child, you know, parenting changes a lot of things. So I have a daughter who's 4.5 years old. And, you know, I've been trying to just enjoy this, you know, phase with her. So I'm digressing, but just wanted to share an anecdote. So she has a keen sense of, you know, looking at various signs. It could be road signs. It could be signs, you know, which are the essential ones like fire exit. And she spots, you know, signs from almost like nowhere. Like you won't be able to even see them sometimes, you know, on a small stool or something. And the kind of questions she asks, because, you know, they are just full of innocence and no preconceived notions as such, you know, just amazes me. And I, you know, I tend to have a smile. I don't have all the answers always. But, you know, for instance, she'll ask, why are dogs not allowed in this, you know, place? I don't understand. And I don't have all the answers, like I said. But it's, you know, it's so interesting. And I'm just kind of now realizing through this journey that knowledge sharing, you know, talking about science has to be a way of life. And I think the way you put it, Martina, was so nice that that's definitely resonated so much with me. So thank you for sharing that insight.
Thanks. And I think it can be extended not only to talking to children or teenagers, but also in our daily lives. If you have the scientific mindset, it could help you make a good decision about, for instance, saving money. Should I pay this amount of money for the salt for my dishwasher, or can I just buy something with a larger granule size for the fraction of the price, right? And this kind of thinking can be applied everywhere in your life. It could be helping you, as I mentioned earlier, clean the apartment. It could help you realize when to go to see the doctor, how to plan your travels, how to be mindful of your carbon footprint, how to recycle properly, how to set up a compost and things like that. What kind of chemistry is happening as you bake and cook? How to improve your cooking abilities and skills? So I think keeping this in mind that science is everywhere around us and being aware of it can only make our life better is important.
Absolutely. No, I fully agree with you, Martina. I think you may have come across a particular journal which is called Frontiers for Young Minds. So there's a publisher, you know, incidentally based in Switzerland, exactly. And you know, we've worked with Frontiers, we talked to them quite a bit. And Frontiers for Young Minds is such a great initiative. And from what I understand, a lot of the audiences, a lot of the traffic that comes to the journal website is actually adults, because they want to understand science in a simpler manner, in a non-complex, you know, manner. And I think it's fascinating just to see that trend increasing. And like you said, you know, science just as a way of life. Just a couple of quick questions, Martina, just while you were talking to Jayashree, I was just curious. So do you talk multiple languages? Do you know multiple languages?
So I speak about 4.5 of them, let's say. but you can only learn so much, right? So when it comes to communicating on social media platforms, I tend to focus on my native language and English. I have been experimenting with German a little bit because I've been living in Switzerland for the past 9 years. So I do speak German. My husband speaks a bit more. So we are language enthusiasts, but it's not on a level where we would be able to share theoretical physics yet.
But still, I mean, 4.5, you know, as you say, is quite impressive, Martina. And one other thing, which will be beneficial for the listeners, how do you keep yourself updated with you know, the latest that is happening in science or specifically chemistry? I mean, there's so much of information available there. You know, how do you keep yourself updated?
It can be a bit overwhelming sometimes, right? When you go online and see the amount of information out there, I think just be selective. You cannot know everything about everything. I tend to focus on areas that I find really interesting or that are really relevant for my daily life. So I do read about the pandemic. I do read about the vaccine development and manufacturing, science and chemistry. I also am really fond of receiving newsletters on a daily basis, either from trade media or science media. And from time to time, I still have the Google Ads set up that I would get a notification anytime someone publishes something in the area of my PhD research, just to, you know, keep the nostalgic connection there going. And also what I do, so it's clear I'm active on social media. I'm also a social media consumer. I follow many science communicators on TikTok, also on Instagram, Twitter, all the hashtags that are relevant to what I do, but also to my interest. So I try to use these platforms not only to create, but also to receive and consume.
Fantastic. Thank you, Martina, for sharing that. And thank you for all the great insights that you've shared today. This has been fabulous.
Thanks for inviting me. It was really enjoyable to speak with you both.
Thank you. This was awesome. And like I said, Nikesh set the right tone. And I think we just went into the conversation and we had so many other questions based on what you said. And I can pick, and as you can see, Nikesh and I picked specific sentences you said. I think we have quotable quotes, a lot of them as well, based on what you said. So thank you so much for doing this with us today. And all the best. And may your Instagram account double, triple, quadruple. May you communicate science even more to a wider audience. And yeah. All the best with it.
Thank you. And thanks again for having me. It was great.
Thank you.
Thank you, everyone, for joining us. You can subscribe to this podcast on all major podcast platforms. Stay tuned for our next episode.
All Things SciComm is brought to you by Science Talks, a science media channel that aims to make science accessible to all. We publish articles, videos, podcasts, and magazines. To read a transcript of this episode or watch it on YouTube, visit sciencetalks.org. Also, write to us with your views, questions, and guest recommendations at contact@sciencetalks.org. Science Talks, bringing science to you.